Now, most of you will know George Hamilton as one of the foremost voices of Irish sport commentary. But this week, he's been honoured for the other side of his work on Lyric FM. He's been inducted into the IMRO Radio Hall of Fame, along with Declan Mean, Patricia Messenger and the late Stephen Clements. And we decided we'd have a chat with George and say congratulations. Congratulations, George!
Thank you so much, Ray. Thank you.
Did it come as a surprise when you got the call?
It did. It did. And to tell you the truth, I wondered, was it the real deal at all? Because you just get this phone call out of the blue from someone you don't know. And you think, I wonder. And they'd say, well, would you consider accepting this award? And you say, of course, thank you. I'm flabbergasted. And how did this come about? And then you hang up the phone and then you wonder, Did I really have that conversation, and was that for real?
Well, it was, and your picture was in the paper yesterday and today, so it is. It's real now, and you have a plaque or a photograph or a trophy or
it's
all of those things.
It's a plaque. It's a plaque. Right. It's something goes up on the wall in the headquarters of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland, and the same thing is just this day, this very day, Kevin, my handyman, came round and he put it up. So it's in my study at home.
Okay, I was going to say you're putting it in the downstairs loo. The study, you're putting it in the study.
Oh, yeah. So that if I ever get the chance to entertain anybody, it might catch their eye, you know.
Right. Is it alongside your baby grand piano? Because I know you've a
yeah.
piano.
Yeah, it is.
I'm building up a picture here, George. Yes.
Yeah.
And there's the cello in the other corner. No, you don't have a cello.
No, I have a guitar. Yeah. The guitar in the other corner. Yeah, Kevin the handyman asked me about that. He said, Kevin Mulligan's his name if he happens to be listening.
Okay.
he said, who plays the guitar? I said, well, I do, but it's been a bit getting a bit dusty recently because there's been a few things going on and I have it at time.
You see, I know this because we spoke about it a number of years ago, that you can play the piano and the cello. I didn't know about the guitar. So it sort of makes sense that you would be on Lyric FM presenting a show with classical music, because it's been there for
it's
all your life.
Yeah. Well, you see, what happened was when I was a kid, it seemed the respectable thing to do to have your little fella learn how to play the piano. And one thing led to another. And that's how the cello came about, because in school, when they were starting up with this rudimentary orchestra, they would ask people to put their hands up if they played the piano. And that meant they could read the bass clef, the lower notes, which then meant they could go onto the cellos. And those who were being taught to read music would be taught on the treble stave, which is where the melody goes. And they would be given violins to attempt to play, as I attempted to play the cello with the other pianists in the class. So that's where the cello came from. But I was going through the grades on the piano all the time anyway. And the cello was in the background playing classical music. Well, of course, the piano was classical music as well. And I suppose it just, like, I was like any other kid, I was mad into the top 10. And I was very much a Beatles fan and a Marmalade fan and a Move fan and a Hollies fan, most of all. And I only realised recently that they were actually named after Buddy Holly, a brilliant band from Manchester fronted by Alan Clark. So I was really into all of that, heading down the old DJ track. And here I am, a DJ, but I'm dealing with older musicians.
No, you see, George, you're not a DJ. You're a broadcaster.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, when you were asked, I'm sure when you have to fill in those forms and they say occupation, you go broadcaster, do you?
I do. Or sometimes journalist. It depends who's asking.
Oh yes, exactly. Yeah, all right. Yeah. Oh, there you go. If it's insurance, it's a journalist, is it, or is it a broadcaster?
No. Well, that's very hard. Very hard to tell as to who they load the most.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I'd say they're up there, both of them together. Great to talk to you.
Thank you. Enjoy the crack.
Yeah, we were just talking there about the Rolling Stone top 500 there, the venue.
Aretha.
So, yeah, Aretha's number one. Like, that's just one of those. Like, that would be in my top five. Now, if we were to ask you, and I was saying that on any particular day, your top five would change. Would that be my situation? Yeah. What about you? Or would you have
It changes all the time. There are ones that I would go back to, of course, and I'm a great fan of Steely Dan and Donald Fagen. But the one that I keep thinking of is the Martha Reeves and the Vandellas Dancing in the Street, which was then redone by David Bowie and Mick Jagger.
Yes.
And we heard it performed at my chum and my former colleague Stephen Alkin. We were doing an Ireland game in Amsterdam, and after the game we went off to a club at the recommendation of the taxi driver, and it was just a bar with a bit of a stage at the top, and there was a band there playing, and they did this unbelievable version of Dancing in the Street, just live, and it was just terrific.
And that's, you see, I remember you've been around the world, obviously, with sport.
Yes.
But you brought that to Lyric as well. So you go to a city and you play the music, and well, you don't actually go, well, but you talk about it.
Yeah, well, that's how the Lyric Show came about, actually, because when I was when Lyric started, the head man was a guy called Seamus Crimmins, who came from Belfast, and I knew him. So we met, and I said, look, if you're ever stuck or need somebody to fill in, I'd be your man. And he manfully tried to get me on the air in some capacity or other, but it never worked because I was doing so many other things. And then Christmas time 2002, he said, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to give you an hour on Christmas Day. Come down to Limerick, record an hour with Gail Henry, the producer, and we'll put it on Christmas Day. So I actually got onto Lyric on Christmas Day 2002. And then Seamus Crimmins left. He went to the Arts Council.
Right.
And that seemed like it was going to be the end of my time pushing the door of Lyric. That, so I said, well, I tried. Anyway, that was that. And months passed. And I was in Moscow for a football match. Turned off the phone because in those days the old mobiles made the microphones crackle.
Yes,
that funny sound that they used to do. So you're under instructions. Turn off your mobile when you're near a microphone. So I had done. And we'd done this match. It was Switzerland. Ireland had a chance of qualifying for whatever it was. Oh, Euro 2000. For in Portugal, but it needed a certain result to happen in Moscow between Russia and Switzerland. Whatever happened anyway, Ireland didn't get to Euro 2004. Mm. But I got in the back of the taxi again with Stephen, and we're bouncing along this ill-paved Moscow street. I turned on my phone, and next thing it vibrated in my pocket, and I looked at it, and there was a message, a voicemail, and I listened to the voicemail, and this voice introduced himself. He said, my name is Aidan O'Doole, you won't know me, but I'm the new head of Lyric. Would you give me a call at your convenience?
Right.
So I'm in the back of the taxi in Moscow, and he said, I just have an idea about you, because presumably there'd been a file left by his predecessor, Seamus, and my name was in it there. So this guy's keen. So Aidan said, I have an idea as I'm adjusting the schedule. I could give you 90 minutes on a Saturday morning, like a football match.
Is that right?
That's what he said. He said, in that 90 minutes, if you played a bit of music that you liked, and obviously Lyric style music, and just talk about where you've been.
A wonderfully simple idea.
Yeah. So it started as a football match, 90 minutes long, and then it expanded to a football match with extra time, right. Which was 2 hours, and it shunted around the schedule. And then he had another idea that he was going to, this is Aidan, that he was going to do programs in strands. So like 10 to 1 would be a strand, and 1 to 4 would be a strand, and 4 to 7 would be a strand. So he'd have people doing those slots Monday to Friday, and then he would have the weekend crew. So I would do 10 to 1. Aideen Gormley with Movies and Musicals and Sunday Matinee would do 1 to 4. And Evelyn Grant would do Weekend Drive at 4 o'clock.
Right.
So he put me on to Sundays in 2016. And I'm on Saturday Sunday now, which is terrific.
And it's hard to believe that you've been there for 18 years, George.
I know. I can't believe it either.
No, because it was big news at the time. I remember thinking, you know, because people were going, George Hamilton, no, he does commentary. It's what's he doing on Lyric?
What's he doing on the radio?
Yeah.
I know. Yeah. It couldn't have bounced better for me. You know, it was one of those that it comes into the box, it drops, and you hit it in the volley, and bang, it's in the back of the net. Because it was now that I look back across the years, I can say this is what I always wanted to do.
Is it?
Yeah. I mean, of course, football.
Oh no,
and sports,
yeah, you love that. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
But this was something that I really, really wanted, because it fulfilled so many. Many different aspects of what I was trying to do with my career, if you like, in that I was enjoying what I was doing. I was getting great feedback because it was obviously going down well. And the other thing about Radio Ray, as you will know well, is that it's a much more intimate medium than television. You know, television with its cast of thousands, you know, can't be instantaneous in the way that radio can be. And you can't connect. And, you know, one of the things I was told when I was starting off back in the 70s in the BBC in Belfast was just think you're talking to one person when you're on the radio. Say it's your granny or your mother or your brother or your sister, but it's one person. It's not a vast audience in front of you. And this is such the thing about radio. When I was, one of my first jobs was as a newsreader in Belfast in the BBC, and that fell to me then to, you know, if my shift was the evening shift, I'd close down the station last thing at night.
Yeah.
And I would read the news bulletin, read a weather forecast, say, well, that's it, we'll be back in the morning, and a very good night to you. And I would get mail from people, mostly people who lived alone, and they'd say, you know, this is great, because I think, you know, I'm going to bed at night. I'm lying there, I've got the radio on, and that's my cue to turn the light out because you say goodnight to you.
Yes.
And that just filled me with such pride that, you know, I was making this connection. It was just, I really, really loved it. And so here I am back again making the connection. And, you know, in these awful times that we've all lived through, Lyric has been such an important part of so many people's lives because it has given them something else apart from the daily diet of what awful thing is going to happen next.
And there was talk about the future of Lyric. So you were probably paying attention to the to and fro on that and
indeed,
the letters page in the Irish Times. So talk me through that time then.
Well, it was difficult because it rather looked like, because of all that was going on in the bigger in the bigger picture, for want of a better expression, that Lyric could have ended up in a very different space. And I think it was fortuitous that COVID came along when it did and reminded us all that Lyric has a very special place, at the one that it occupies right now. And it deserves to stay there because of what it does. You know, what it provides across the days, across the weeks, across the year. It gives such a space for people to retreat into and almost pull the curtains and let the world disappear.
Yeah.
And you know, that phrase they came up with when they were promoting it years ago, where life sounds better. You know, it does. It does.
We got Rachel to ask you, or maybe Fiona, to pick three clips.
Oh, yes.
Now, I have them here. They're just clips because you are a man that would play a full movement,
yes,
would you? How long would a movement be?
Well, it depends.
How long would your movement be?
I'm not going to go that far. That's much too much information. The movements, it depends on the composer, but you'll find those in the classical period, like the Haydns, the Mozarts, they'd be short enough. They could be like 5 minutes or less.
Yeah.
But if you go into the Romantics and towards the later part of the 19th century, and you'll find a Johannes Brahms movement. I mean, my favourite movement of Brahms is 6 minutes or 6 minutes long, third movement of the Third Symphony. But you'll find you could be up to 9 or 10, and then you'll have 15-minute movements as well, you know, as they wanted to get it all out.
Right, we play this one and you can tell us why you like it so much.
Okay.
See, I recognise that immediately, but would never be able to name it.
Mozart Clarinet Concerto.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, when Fiona asked me, I had to say Mozart because he's my absolute favourite. He can do no wrong. He covers all the bases in what he wrote. And, you know, he epitomises what a musician was back in those days. This was his job. Mm. And he had to write music to make money. So he was never forever writing the music. And then he would perform as well. And his father came to see him from Salzburg to his place in Vienna. And he said, I can't believe what goes on here. Every day there are removal men carrying the piano in and out to one concert venue or one salon or another. Mozart, he was writing all day and playing all night, and it was just he was the, well, I nearly said journeyman. He was anything but. He was a genius, but he covered all the bases. He wrote for all the instruments, and it's just beautiful music, and it's just serene.
See, we forget that when it was contemporary, it was for the masses.
Yeah, absolutely.
And now it's viewed and perceived as elitist.
Yeah. Which it isn't at all.
Yeah.
I mean, it was created for the masses. It wasn't written so that nobody would hear it. It was written to entertain people.
Yeah.
And people came out to listen to it and enjoy it. And of course, there were no recordings. So the only way to hear the music was to hear it actually played. And if you had enough dosh and you could afford your own house band, well, you had it played in your house. I mean, Haydn was the music master for the Esterhazys,
right,
outside Vienna. They had their place in Eisenstadt where they lived, their seat, country seat. And he developed a style of writing because he was away from Vienna and he wasn't subject to any of these influences that he might have been contemporaries around who'd say you should have been doing this or should have been doing that.
Yeah.
So he was able to develop the idea of the symphony without being bothered by convention or what appeared to be convention or was becoming convention. And then the other thing about him was he had this house band and he had these players in it and they were all star men and women and he wanted them to be happy in their work. So he would write concertos for each of the instruments so that they would all get a chance to shine.
And that was literally A house band.
Yes, literally a house band. I mean, the other story about the house band is that Bach's Brandenburg Concertos, he didn't call them the Brandenburg Concertos. They were lost and then found. And where they were found, it was realised they were in the collection of the Margrave of Brandenburg, who owned them. Bach had written them and given them to him. But why? What had happened to them was when Bach had handed over the music, six concertos, the Margrave took them home to his country seat and he looked at the scores and he said, no, my band can't play these, there aren't enough musicians. So he stuffed them in a drawer and forgot about them. And it was only years later that they turned up and it was realised that they'd been in his collection, that they were subsequently named the Brandenburg Concertos. But they were written for this guy who had a house band, but the house band wasn't big enough to play them.
Right, this one. Very serene.
Yes, that's Franz Liszt, Liebestraum number 3. All top pianists will give you a version of that. A lovely romantic piano solo, A Dream of Love, one of the set of three that Franz Liszt wrote. He was a great showman. He performed to great acclaim in his day. He was possibly the first rock and roll star. He might have been the Bono of his day. He'd come onto the stage to the piano. He'd have silk gloves on and he'd have a silk handkerchief protruding from his breast pocket, and he'd take them off ceremoniously and he'd lay them on the piano and he'd play his set. And when it was all over, they'd rush the stage to try and get these trinkets that Liszt had left behind. Rock star.
Yeah, it's like a drumstick.
Exactly.
Okay, from that to this.
David O'Leary is entrusted with the responsibility of taking the penalty that could send Ireland into the quarterfinals of the World Cup. This kick can decide it all. The nation holds its breath. Yes, we're there!
That was a fabulous bit of jocking you did there.
It's about pace, George.
Exactly.
We went from Liebestraum to a stadium in Italy in 1990.
Another kind of dream.
Yeah. Now, the reason I play that is that I'll never tire of listening to that. And I always, you know, the hairs and the goosebumps and all that sort of thing happen. But also because you can announce it now.
Oh, yes.
It's an exclusive. Yeah. Go for it, George.
November the 2nd, The Nation Holds Its Breath, a memoir. By your man.
By your man, George Hamilton.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to reading
that. Very impressed.
Yeah.
I'm delighted.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, like, I can't believe, and I'm looking at your age here, George, and I should do the maths on it and all, but you're 71.
Yeah, I know. I can't believe it either.
Yeah.
I don't quite know how I got here.
It flies in, doesn't it?
It does. But it's just one of those things. You can't deny the number, so you just got to get on with it. Yeah.
So how was that experience writing a memoir?
Pretty tough. I'd never written a book before. I do a column every week in the Irish Independent on a Saturday, but that's 550 words, which is not quite the same.
It's two pages of a book.
80,000 words.
Yeah.
So it was pretty tough going, but I had a terrific team behind me in the Merion Press, Conor Graham and Patrick O'Donoghue, who were hand-holding every step of the way, and their patience is unbelievable. But they've managed to get me over the finishing line, and so it's ready to rock. And I'm delighted, actually.
And the title wrote itself, really, didn't it?
Well, I was going to call it something else.
Well, go on. What are you going to call it?
I had a great idea for, because of all the travelling I do and because of the lady in my life, Linda, would be inclined to be a bit tidier than me. So my title was going to be, I'm off to Barcelona, don't throw anything out.
There was a lovely window into your domestic life, George Hamilton.
Yeah.
I'm off to Barcelona. Don't move anything around.
No, and don't. Indeed. Indeed.
Where's that? I didn't see it anywhere. And then you find it in a drawer somewhere. Now, anyway, that's enough of that. Yeah, okay. So we're going to have lovely behind-the-scenes descriptions of you know, a nation holds its breath. Being there in the stadium, hearing the roar of those Irish fans.
They were incredible days, incredible days. Of course, all beginning 2 years before that in Stuttgart and Hanover and Gelsenkirchen with Euro 88. Funny enough, Ronnie Whelan rang me up today about something else entirely. It was great to be talking to, you know, an old star who scored the goal off his shin from Mick McCarthy's throw-in in Hanover in 88 against the Soviet Union. You know, that's where the phrase danger here came from.
No, go on, because that's one of yours as well. Yeah, danger here. Go on.
They even created a website about it.
Right.
I was in Mulligan's in Poolbeg Street one night, and these guys came up and said, "I can't believe I'm talking to you. We've just started a website, dangerhere.com. They were playing the Soviet Union, and it was 1-0, Ronnie Whelan's goal, and the game was 15 minutes to go, and Packy Bonner had made a save and cleared the ball up the field. And I made the remark that he'd gone a lot of minutes without conceding a goal. In fact, he was in line for his clean sheet. And, of course, it's statistically proven that I'm responsible for 87% of the late goals that Ireland concede. Anyway, the ball, in the time that I was taken to say all this, was moving from left to right, from Russian goalkeeper through the midfield, up to Oleg Protasov, who promptly plunked it into Packy Bonner's net. Not before I'd said, "Danger here! 1-1.
The commentator's hex.
Exactly.
The curse of the commentator. You're not the only one, but it's. I'm sure somebody has done an academic study on this, George.
I'm sure they have.
You know, because a certain amount of time elapses, it's more likely that the opponents are going to score. You're looking for something to say because the action might have died down, and you're summing up the whole situation. You're saying, "Oh yeah, doing really well," and next thing, gone.
Not so well.
Not so well. Okay, we had you on during the Olympics for this, but we're going to play it again because it's a lovely memory of the summer of 2021 and the Tokyo Olympics. Here we go.
They're home and hosed. They're ahead by a length. It's Ireland from Germany, and history is made on the water in Tokyo as Fintan McCarthy and Paula Donovan win gold. Gold for Ireland! Gold for Ireland! Silver for Germany! And the Italians come home in third place. And that is one more chapter of magnificence from the men from County Cork.
Ah, one more chapter of magnificence, George. And did you save a chapter for that?
No.
No, that's not mentioned in
No. Unfortunately,
because that was a big moment in your life, wasn't it?
It was a very big moment. It was a huge moment in my life because I've had huge privileges in the commentary box over all the years. The World Cup finals, the Olympic 100-metre finals, Sonia O'Sullivan winning the gold medal at the World Championships, and all of that in Gothenburg in 1995, and many, many another gold along the way for Ireland in various disciplines. But never until that morning, an Olympic gold. Yeah. I've never commentated on an Irish Olympic gold until that very moment.
And just to remind people that you don't have those words ready to go. They come out of your head.
They do. Yes. Yeah, I know. It's some doubt that, and some think it's hard to fathom. But it's part of the process of being a commentator.
Yeah.
Is that you work out various scenarios and you do your homework, and you put yourself in a position to be able to find the words when the moment comes.
Okay, here's a question, George Hamilton. Have you ever been surprised at what came out of your mouth?
I think that nation holds its breath thing.
Is it? Yeah.
Because I would say it has happened more than once because it's, you know, sometimes you will get a notion with 5 minutes to go that this is relevant because all the stuff that's been whizzing around in your brain lands on this particular square, so to speak.
Yeah.
If it stays like this, I might say that.
Yeah.
But then the game goes on and then it gets forgotten about.
Of course.
And then all of a sudden it's back again, like a, you know, an earworm. That would work. But no, because if you script it, it's going to sound scripted.
It is,
And it's and the whole thing about, I think the thing about successful commentary is the spontaneity. Of course you do your homework, of course you make notes, of course you have reminders, but I don't think, and it would be my tip to anybody who was thinking of trying to make a way in it, is don't try and write it beforehand.
Okay.
Because you're never going to know how it's going to turn out.
A Nation Holds Its Breath will be out in November. I'm sure you got, there was...
It's The Nation, Ray.
Sorry, The Nation, not A Nation. Then Nation Holds Its Breath, sorry. It was a bit freaky there because I don't know if you noticed it, George, but in the ad break before you came on, there was an ad about heart valve awareness.
Oh, yeah.
And that'll be a chapter in the book as well, I would imagine, from 2011 when you had your...
No, that's not in there either.
It's not in there either. Right,
no.
Okay.
You see, the thing is that there was so much... And an awful lot ended up on the cutting room floor,
right. Sadly. Okay.
Yeah. And well, I thought it's such an upbeat thing that I didn't want to be going downbeat.
Okay, fair enough.
And it's a while ago and it's history. Medical science is wonderful. And never forget the professor by the name of Keane in UCD. He said, hey, this is serious, but it's fixable and we'll fix it. And that's what they did.
And he did.
Yeah.
Right, we'll talk to you again, I'm sure, around the release of the book, or maybe you might go on the Late Late Show or something like that, I don't know. But anyway, congratulations on
being inducted
into the Radio Hall of Fame. George Hamilton, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, George.
Mind yourself. Thank you, Ray. Thank you for having me.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.